All of Britain hung in the balance. Nazi air raids were decimating English cities, and the Nazi war machine was primed for an invasion of the home islands. The British Expeditionary Force barely escaped Dunkirk. It was in no position to repel the enemy. And that was when Winston Churchill took to the radio and unleashed some of the most powerful rhetoric that the world has ever heard. It was what the people of the British Isles needed to hear. On December the 7th, 1941, the Empire of Japan launched a devastating surprise attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. Over 2,000 Americans were killed and thousands more were injured, and the country of America once again was in shock. The following day, President Franklin Roosevelt addressed the Congress and the American people and rallied them to rise in righteous anger against the day of infamy. It was what our nation needed to hear. 2001, evil agents took civilians captive on airplanes and slammed them into the World Trade Center, into the Pentagon, and this time over 3,000 American lives were lost, and once again, our country was in shock. What our nation needed and what we received from President Bush was someone who would say, "I can understand your fear. I know the enemy. I have a plan to deal with them. I know what we're going to do to face the coming days, and we will overcome this hardship and this tragedy together." Now, that's the essential message that you're going to find in the fourth chapter of the book of Revelation. God was saying to the young church, "I understand your fear. I know the enemy. I have a plan to deal with your enemies. I know what we're going to do to face the coming days, and we will overcome as we face this hardship and this tragedy together." Listen to these words from Revelation 4. "After this, I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. And the voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, 'Come up here. I will show you what must take place after this.' At once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. And the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian. A rainbow resembling an emerald encircled the throne. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seated on them were 24 elders. They were dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their heads." Notice what's happening. Jesus tells John he's about to see what must take place after this. Now, we're all familiar with what's about to come. We're familiar with those horrendous pictures of war and famine and pestilence and death that we read about in the following chapters of the book of Revelation. Preachers and teachers often make a living telling people about those particular chapters, and they jump past those first five chapters and jump immediately into the horrors of the book. In this past couple of weeks, I assume most of you have probably received the flyer announcing a series of lessons on prophecy that will deal with the book of Revelation and deal with the number 666 in Armageddon. If you turn in on the radio and TV evangelists, you'll find that they often talk about this. But Jesus doesn't jump into the pictures of the future. Instead, we find ourselves in God's throne room, and we find ourselves witnessing an awesome worship service. It's filled with strange sights and sounds. There's lightning and thunder and rumblings in the distance. There are beautiful colors. There are unusual creatures. There's an inspiring example of how to praise God. Now, if Jesus told John what he is about to see and what is going to take place after this, then why would a worship service be the first thing that John was allowed to see? Why visit this beautiful and yet seemingly irrelevant ceremony considering what's about to happen? Why not just get down to the nitty-gritty of all of it and just tell us what we really want to know about? Tell us about the conflict of the forces of good and evil. Tell us about the conflict between the forces of Satan, the angels of God. But Jesus does not do that. Instead, he leads us into a service of praise. And we wonder, why do we start here? And the answer is because that's where God knew we needed to start. He knew it was what we needed to hear. We need to realize that when we read the book of Revelation, it's possible for us to focus on the wrong things, because that is done quite often. Most of the time when you read a newspaper article or a media article, or you happen to watch one of the TV evangelists, they're talking about the powers of darkness and the mark of the beast and the battle of Armageddon and so on. But most, if not all of you, have heard about the mark of the beast described as 666 in Revelation 13. And yet over the past 50 years or so, prophetic teachers have gotten people so scared about the prophecy of the mark of the beast that many people have honestly made nuisances of themselves fighting any attempt of our government to use Social Security numbers or identification cards or anything of the sort. If there's even the hint that 666 will end up being part of a phone number, people won't accept it. Motels will not set up a room with the number 666 on it. Some folks go absolutely ballistic because they fear that the mark of the beast might be placed on them unawares. So, why are they so afraid? Because these teachers of prophecy make them afraid. Now, a couple of questions. Where do we read about the mark of the beast? In the book of Revelation. And who tells us about the mark of the beast? Well, God does. So, do you suppose that God knew all of this was going to happen? Of course he did. And do you think that he had planned a way to deal with it? Naturally, we're pretty sure he had. So if God knew what was supposed to happen and he made plans to deal with it, do you think there's any point in us worrying over it? And the answer is, of course not. Now, in addition, the way God describes the mark of the beast in Revelation chapter 13, it's very obvious that Christians won't be marked by it one day and then suddenly discover the next day that they've been hoodwinked. When the mark came, and I believe it came during centuries, many centuries ago, when God's people were suffering from economic deprivation a long time before any of us were born. But even if it is future, Christians will, in fact, be forced to make a decision. Decision is simple. You take the mark and worship the beast and survive physically, or you follow Jesus and you suffer. And that's basically the story. And it's the story that's happened in every generation. Now, when I did some research on the mark of the beast on the internet, I found and encountered a lot of rather strange comments. One prominent speculation was the mark of the beast was simply an implantable microchip. And this chip would identify who you are, and it would be similar to the photograph on your driver's license. Someone else speculated that it would be a number like your Social Security number, a part of your credit card number. Some actually said it's like a password or a PIN number. You'd need it to take out money or authorize transactions. One site showed a picture of a barcode, and it stated that each barcode in existence had 666 embedded somewhere within it. And one of the authors actually wrote, "The real truth is this. The astounding prophecies of doom and a great Antichrist is just a smokescreen used by the Dark Brotherhood to cast an illusion over the real beast and the meaning of 666, so the masses will continue to bear the mark." It's really easy to apply the old joke about the man who was talking to his friend, and he actually said, "Just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean these guys are not out to get me." These guys are paranoid, and it's easy to understand why. Book of Revelation can be a scary book. Revelation is not a book that I would read to my grandchildren for a bedtime story. There really are some frightening images found in the book, and God knows that. And that's why you have the vision of the throne room before you read about any of those other frightening images. Now consider the image that Revelation 4 places in our minds. First of all, the image is one of an awesome God, a powerful being beyond anything that we comprehend. Secondly, it's unearthly. There's odd creatures that are found in this throne room. And yet somehow it's comforting. There are 24 elders. They wear crowns and white garments. And these elders look at least something like us. And God is worshipped by everything in heaven and on earth. And everything and everyone subjects itself to God. Not because they have to, but because they want to, because He's worthy. Everything is voluntary, it's spontaneous, it's filled with excitement and joy, and there's a sense of wonder and a sense of power. And there's an assurance that if this is my God, my enemies better watch out. Now, the images that follow, starting in chapter 5 and going through chapter 19, can be frightening and overwhelming. But this is saying God is bigger than any of that. Nothing the world or the underworld can throw at us can even come close to what God has planned for us. He occupies the higher ground, and absolutely nothing can stand against His power. It's like John wrote in 1 John 1:4, "You are of God and have overcome, because greater is He that is in you than is he that is in the world." Jesus had taught in John 16, "I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." And that's the message Revelation chapter 4 is trying to drive home. We are going to have trouble in this world, and it really doesn't matter how we read the book of Revelation, because that truth is inescapable. But take heart, because God and Christ will overcome all of the evil that is imaginable. Last night, after watching the Chicago Cubs win the National League pennant and advance to their first World Series in 70 years, I switched back over to the Ole Miss-LSU football game. Commentator was Brent Musburger, and he made the announcement that the Cubs had won, and then he said, "I never thought I would ever be able to say that on the air." And it's sort of understandable. Last night, the TV zoomed in on 87-year-old Billy Williams. He played for the Cubs for 16 years in the 50s and 60s and 70s. He's been retired for 40 years. And at age 87, as he was being interviewed, you could tell he was having trouble processing that moment because it was so historic. It was sort of mysterious because it never happened like this before. Since the last time the Cubs played in a World Series, 1,275 different men have played for the Cubs. Not a one of them played on a World Series team. 606 different men threw at least one pitch for the Cubs in that period. None of them ever threw one in a World Series game. The Cubs played 11,309 baseball games. None of them World Series games. World Series games were played in 45 different ballparks, none of which were known as Wrigley Field. At Coors Field, yes. At Chase Field, yes. Ebbets Field and Citi Field, even at Tropicana Field. But at iconic Wrigley Field, never. Yankees had played in 26 World Series during that time, the Dodgers in 15, the Cardinals in 11, and the Cubs were always sitting at home watching in their living rooms all of the things that were taking place. Ernie Banks was one of their great players. He played in more than 2,500 games. Billy Williams in more than 2,200. Ryan Sandberg and Ron Santo in more than 2,100. But none of them were ever in a World Series box score. As we look at that and think about it, a lot of people look at the book of Revelation and they class Satan and his demons as undefeatable. And yet Revelation 4 tells us not only will we be able to overcome, it actually tells us how we go about doing it. We overcome by following the example of those who are in the throne room. And look at what they were doing. They're singing praises to God. They're worshiping the Father. They're focusing all of their attention on Him, and everything is centered on the throne in the midst of the room. And when we do these things on a regular basis, when we praise and when we worship our God, we focus our attention solely on Him and on His throne, and we realize Satan is not undefeatable. With this in mind, as we begin to do that and learn that, we begin to develop an appreciation of God's power. And we begin to understand why the four living creatures cry out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." Because God has always been there in the past. Satan hasn't. God will always be present in the future. Satan, in some sense, will not. God will always be there when we need Him. Satan will not. God will never leave us or forsake us. Satan would. Even in our darkest moments, God is there for us. And so the 24 elders cast their crowns before the throne, and they sing, "You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being." And this is the God that has created everything, and He simply did that by His word. He's a God of awesome power and a God of awesome might, and we will overcome because we have the power of God in our corner. And I know I've shared the story before, but it fits so well here, so bear with me. Back in 1607, a German named Martin Reinhardt wrote a powerful hymn that has been sung for over 400 years in our churches. "Now thank we all our God with heart and hands and voices, who wondrous things has done, in whom His world rejoices, who from our mother's arms has blessed us on our way with countless gifts of love, and still is ours today." In the year that he wrote that hymn, 6,000 people in his German village, including his wife and children, died of the plague, pestilence. And yet he wrote that word. He's quoting from Revelation chapter 4. The last verse goes, "All praise and thanks to God the Father now be given, the one eternal God whom earth and heaven adore. For thus it was, is now, and shall be evermore. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, for I have overcome the world." We need to set our heart and our soul on the one who has the power to help us in the face of our tragedies and our heartaches. And that's what worship is all about. And that's why Jesus takes John into the throne room before he reveals the troubles that will follow. Because he wants John to understand that even in those troubles, there will be a place for worship because God will still be worthy. And even in those troubles, they will only be limited in time, and there will be something much greater in the future. An elementary teacher by the name of Phyllis Martin once told the following story about an event that took place in Columbus, Ohio. She wrote, "Storm clouds and strong gusts of wind had come up suddenly over Columbus. Alpine Elementary School radio blared tornado warnings. It was too dangerous to send the children home, and so we took them to the basement where the children huddled together in fear, and those of us who were teachers were worried too. To help ease the tension, the principal suggested that we do a sing-along, but the voices from the kids were weak and unenthusiastic, and child after child began to cry, and we couldn't calm them. And then a teacher whose faith seemed equal to any emergency whispered to the child closest by, 'Aren't you forgetting something, Kathy? There's a power greater than the storm that will protect us. Just say to yourself, God is with us in the storm.' And then you pass the words to the child next to you." And it was amazing as a sense of peace settled over the children. I could still hear the force of the wind outside blowing with the ferocity that it had moments before, but now it didn't seem to matter to the children. Inside, fear had subsided, tears had faded away, and when the all-clear signal came, everybody went back to the classrooms, smiling. I have again been able to find release from the tensions by repeating over and over in my own life, God is with us in the storms. That's the purpose of Revelation chapter 4. Before the storms hit, there was the period of worship. Before the storms hit, there was a calmness in heaven. The calmness was there because God knew the eventual outcome. God controlled the eventual outcome, and nothing could shake that. In the next few weeks, I want us to use the book of Revelation a little differently as we try to look at some devotional messages like this from the book rather than the things that I usually do in Bible class when I teach from this particular piece of literature written by John. But it's so special in the way it opens. It opens this way, and it will close in the same way. And as one person has said on another occasion, do you understand the book of Revelation? And the answer was coming back to them, said, no, but I do know this, in the end, we win. That's the story of God's book. Tonight, if you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, maybe there's some storms in your life. Best place to find shelter in the time of storms is in the presence of God and in His people. His people can pray for you, and His people are willing to stand by you and put their arms around you and care for you and help you in those times of struggle. If you need to respond in any way, we encourage you to come as we stand and as we sing.